Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dale, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Well, US markets are still making all-time highs. It's not the only game in town. There are pretty extraordinary things happening all over the place at the moment, certainly if you know where to look. It is always a pleasure to have Julian McCormack from Platinum International join us. He's so thoughtful about the world and the history of asset prices and economies. He's talked to us about all sorts of interesting things over the years. And as we find ourselves at another fascinating point in time, he's kindly agreed to share his thoughts. Julian, thanks so much for joining me.
Gemma, g'day.
I didn't expect that start. I thought you were going to say something else.
No, I couldn't think of what to say, so I just said hello.
Excellent. Good start. Yeah. Excellent start. Wanted to start with China. We haven't spent a lot of time on China for a while. It's drifted downwards and then just kind of fallen off a cliff. It's now, what, 15-year lows, close to 15-year lows. That's not pretty.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us why, for a start?
Yeah, the start point's important. So one of the greatest bubbles of all time was China from about 02 to 07. So the Shanghai Composite gets to about 6,000 and change and then never takes out that high again. So not dissimilar to Japan in 89. Different drivers. So Japan in 89, up to Japan in 89, was the most spectacular corporate lending bubble. Unbelievable corporate indebtedness. That came later in China. So there wasn't a whole lot of debt in China up to the 07 peak. There was a couple of shared elements. Massive capital formation, but it was actually in the form of profit. So build special economic zones, export like mad, trap those in a captive capital account. So if you have literally when you go and get RMB in China, and then you take it out of China, it's useless. Like you can't use it, right? So because it's a genuinely captive capital account. So it's a non-exchangeable currency basically outside of China. There's fringe cases, but that's by and large true. And then you get this raging exuberance in China. So you could literally buy Chalco or Chinalco on like 30 times earnings, or Alcoa or Alcan back in those days on 9 times earnings, and they were the same business. So you could just see this was the most spectacular bubble. And remember, back then everyone loved it. So it was the mining boom, it was bricks, it was, you know, if I sell, you know, 1 gram of lead to every person in China, you know, that kind of reasoning just straight lined out forever. Then that sort of falls apart in the... Well, it doesn't sort of fall apart. It catastrophically falls apart in the GFC because they have basically an entrepot economy of staggering scale. So what do I mean by that? It's stuff coming in, getting transformed and getting shipped out. So, you know, really simplistically, iron ore in, turned into manufactures, exported. And then 08 happens. So I was actually marketing corporate opportunities in investment banking, in mining to companies in China in late 08, early 09. And, you know, I'd get through half a meeting, not even, I'd get through 10 minutes of a conversation with the head of business at, you know, business development at Jiangxi Copper or somewhere. And he'd say, oh, yeah, it's all interesting, but are we going to have another Lehman Brothers? That's in China. That's in China.
Wow.
So that's, and the ripple effect is felt everywhere. So scrap, steel, heavy melt scrap, iron ore, copper, every base metal, basically every traded commodity, all the prices of those fell by at least 50% and many 90% in the course of about 2 months in early 09. And that's why BHP and everyone now tries to price not on contract but on some form of spot. Because imagine you lock in a price for a year, which you used to do with met coal and iron ore, and then the price goes up, the buyer just takes the gap between the spot price and the contract price. But then when they don't do that on the way down, it feels a bit unfair. And that's exactly what happened. So there was a collapse of global aggregate demand. They were an export-led economy, and then they had this, you know, really serious underutilization of resources, i.e. staggering levels of unemployment. So in Chinese New Year 09, the largest human migration each year happens, and then they don't have jobs to come back to. And then China freaks out. So from that point on through to about 2015, you get this hugely deflationary overcapacity build out in steel, aluminium, iron ore and coal to a much lesser degree. Their resources in those commodities aren't very good. Roads, bridges, blah, 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 apartment buildings, all that stuff. So all that stuff that everyone's been worried about, it's not that it ceased to be a problem, but it was realised and dealt with by 2016 latest. And if you want to see a proper slowdown in China, you can just go and find Chinese rail freight movements in tonne kilometre, and they fall from memory 35% from about 2013 to about early 2016. So the largest physical economy in the world is moving 35% less stuff over 3 years. So that's the backdrop, and they've been muddling through that problem ever since. And so what's kind of frustrating for people who really have to stay close to this situation day to day is when the rest of the world, when some, you know, screen jockey in Connecticut catches up with all that, right, and figures out, oh, but also then you get this heavy political overlay. So, you know, like the Yanks can blame the Chinese for everything, right? They can blame them for a large trade deficit. They can blame them for the, you know, the hollowing out of manufacturing. They can blame them for their opioid epidemic as well. Oh, the fentanyl's all coming from China. So, like, they can just blame them for everything now, right? So the Yanks are beginning to impound cars made by VW because they've got, like, componentry in them from China. So it's getting, so now you get the political overlay on top of a deep economic slowdown, which is caused by having to remake the economic model that got them to where they got to. And that's very, very hard work. So we get reported to in the West as if China's always wrong, and everyone seems to forget that the most successful industrialization in human history just happened there.
When I was younger, it was always Japan, which we'll talk about too.
Right. And Japan is a beautiful analog because it's a very similar economic model. Right. So Japan ran itself on a war economy model from the end of the war, and I mean that perfectly literally. Like, the same people who did the military expansionism of the 30s were running the economy in the 50s. Right. You hung a few blokes at the top, like literally, and the same people were in charge, and they ran the economy the same way. Right. So, you know, we love to labour under the misapprehension that we live in a world that has consistent and universal human values and human rights and economic institutions and political institutions and all that, and we don't. Like, if Japan's a democracy, I'm a Dutchman's uncle. It doesn't look anything like it. It doesn't function anything like it. We rock up every few years and have a vote, and we've had one party in power uninterrupted apart from 3 years, right? The LDP has run Japan the whole time uninterrupted. That doesn't look very democratic, right? So is it free? It's free-ish, right? Is there a rule of law? Not really, right? So literally, if you're a foreigner and you get into a fight in a bar in Japan and you hurt a Japanese person, do you reckon you get charged with anything? No. You get to a police station, you get the stripes belted off you, and you get told you'd better be out of the country in a couple of days. That's not me, but it's not someone far from me.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's one of the more unusual conversations we've had on this
that's
podcast.
That's not a maybe. That happened, right? So now think about, okay, you're a foreign entity operating in Japan and you want to sue a Japanese company? Yeah, good luck. You're a foreign entity and you're operating in Singapore, Thailand, China, India, and you want to sue one of those countries, good luck. That's going to go really well. But Everyone knows, oh, no, no, we all have the same economic institutions and it's all the same. It's just not the same, right? And that applies to Germany. It applies to the Scandis. It applies to France. It applies to New Zealand. It applies to Australia. It applies to America. It's everywhere. There are all these different shades of things and they're all using markets for different purposes. And the genuine ideologues who operate in financial markets will see one truth, and that one truth in China is the mode of regulation now suits capital less than it did, say, 15 years ago, and that is 100% true. So capital accumulation was really unfettered. Environmental legislation was very poor. Employment legislation, or enforcement of regulation, sorry, rather than legislation, around employment law remains very poor in China, to be fair. Environmental stuff has been cracked down on like you can't believe. There is no city in China that is ever in the top 10 of most polluted large populaces in the world now, ever.
Interesting.
Ever. There were half of them 15 years ago.
Yes, so Beijing 15 years ago.
Other places got more polluted, so that's fair, like as other places industrialise more. But it's like Mexico City, three big cities in India, a couple of big cities in there's a couple in Latin America actually which have poor sort of microclimates around them as well. But none of those big Chinese industrial cities are. And literally you walk around Beijing and see blue skies all the time.
Yeah, right. I remember being there when you couldn't see anything.
Yeah. So this place has changed very dramatically, and what we get presented in the West is, oh, well, it's Xi Jinping's war on everything. Like there was some headline in the ABC that said that, you know, last year. And yet let's just think about what they're doing. So they're trying to make housing affordable. Well, that sounds really stupid, doesn't it? Sounds like a really dumb thing to do in a society. While still using markets to achieve it, by the way. So they haven't nationalised anything, they haven't stopped anything happening, is it? Right. They want less speculation in the housing market and they want less fly-by-night, highly indebted property developers to be operating, and that's happening. So that's one big area. That's the biggest area of it.
Mm.
Then people will be somewhat familiar perhaps with the tech regulation type stuff, which always gets presented as really weird, except, you know, Ursula von der Leyen does stuff against Google and Microsoft and Amazon all the time. But they're European, so it's different, right? Oh, really? It's analogous. They don't want their kids growing up in front of screens, you know, 3 hours a day or something's fine, but, you know, more than that's not.
Some count, no
and so,
count.
And so that these are things that are less amenable to capital, free capital formation than in other jurisdictions, but very recognisable.
Mm.
Like none of this is weird or psycho. The mode of delivery is very, very unfamiliar to us in the West. Indeed, if you want to find what any sort of hard regulation is on pretty much anything, you won't find it. You can't find it. You'll just look and look and look. And that is the absolute core of the system. That's how it works. It's a 2,500-year-old continuously existing imperial system. And the bad times aren't when there's tight control. The bad times are when there's no control, right? Like when there's no control, there's like warring factions and it's really nasty and life expectancy goes down a lot and it's awful. And when there's tight control, all the infrastructure works really well. There's a few like, oh, I have to be careful about what I say at times and, oh, you know, mind your P's and Q's and blah, blah, blah. But the state is very operational and my life is better. That's just Chinese history. So we're in one of those epochs with a tightening of control around a whole bunch of stuff with one of the most popular political leaders probably in recorded human history. If you don't think Xi Jinping is popular with the everyday masses in China, you're mad. You're mad. We don't have good poll data on it, by the way. So the Gates Foundation Pew Research did one, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. There was a bit of friction around Shanghai in particular around lockdowns, but ask the everyday Chinese person, they think COVID was handled awesome. And why wouldn't they? They have a full court press and press apparatus telling them that every day.
Mm.
So, like, you know, you've probably come to believe it. So all of this is just by way of context around saying this is a very functional place going through a very, very large shift in how it governs itself, which is getting really hyped in the West, which looks much less spectacular if we're close to it, because it's been happening glacially over time with not that many weird or irrational outcomes. And there are some, by the way. There are some. So the sort of semi or in effect nationalisation of the non-school education sector was really weird. That was just overnight, that bang. The eradication of a whole bunch of economic measures is pretty weird, right?
No, so unemployment statistics, that sort of stuff.
Let's not measure youth unemployment anymore. It is also pretty weird. And in reality, what they need to do is have a highly paid or more highly paid, in inverted commas, unskilled labour sector, which they don't have. Because they have they have massive numbers of uni graduates and quite high percentage, I can't remember the number now, but it's quite high relative to GDP per capita in terms of uni graduates for insufficient jobs. Right, so it's, what are you going to get in an economy that's sort of really ratcheting away itself and changing itself? And that's a place with heaps of problems that are really difficult to solve, and everyone knows what they are. Big deal, move on, right? So, and now you're just stepping up and buying businesses. So you can buy BYD. I'm 50-50 on BYD, not a recommendation, blah, blah, blah. But you're buying this thing that's gone from 500,000 cars to 3 million cars, going to 6 million cars probably in about 4 years. So they reckon they'll do 4 and a bit million cars this year. So 6 in 3 is, or 4 is pretty conservative. You're getting that on about 15 times this year, probably 12 times next year in terms of earnings. The margins, I'm a bit unclear on the margins because there's a price war going on, but that's my best guess. That's cheap, right? People want to buy Tesla on a bazillion times earnings.
It was 300 times at one point.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of infinity times earnings x the credits.
Yes.
And the credits
yes.
all go away, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They all go away once we all make EVs. There'll be some buyers of them. Like Porsche might have to buy some for a while and blah, blah, blah. But the market in those things is going away. And they don't have any models. They're effectively a one-model company. If you can tell me the difference between an S and X and a 3 and a Y, I'd be real. Maybe it's 2.
Probably not the person.
And then they've got this sort of, novelty truck thing that's really cool. So, the 3-ton stainless steel truck. So the relativities of all these things are really, really out of whack. And China's just relatively cheap. Risk is it'll stay cheap for a long time. Probably a pretty good chance to stay cheap for a very long time. Every time I've had that conversation with myself, I've made money.
Interesting.
If your biggest fear is it's dead money for a while, you're going to make a lot of money.
Interesting.
Because everyone knows it. So no one wants to buy it. I've just done that with the global shipping industry. Sat there, talked to every shipping company in the world, literally. And then thought, it's a bit hard and I don't know. And then, literally 3 weeks later, shipping rates go through the roof. Which is pretty unlucky, to be fair. So
there were some very specific events
that
catalyzed that.
Bad stuff,
right?
That happened and pretty macabre to worry about the shipping rates. But anyway, that's the backdrop in China. I'd ask people, just go and look at what Charlie Munger said about China for the last 10 years. One of the great American capitalists. And just go and see what he says about it. Don't take my word for it.
It's such an interesting one because it gets hyped when things are going well, super hyped. It was having worked closely with some stockbrokers sort of in the post-GFC era, it was always, it's all about China, it's all about China, it's all about China, stronger for longer, all this kind of thing. And then when it starts to slow down, everyone stops talking about it and it's back to regulatory risk and all the concerns. And now the conversations are non-existent, one might imagine. Yeah, really, we're not talking about it at all. Yep. It seems to be very quiet.
Yep.
Very quiet.
Yeah, and that's how it feels for us. Like we're investing there and it's like, oh, what's the point. Right? Because that's how it feels, right?
That's so depressing.
Yeah. Because you've just been grinding away on this thing.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, oh, well, it's cheap, is it? That's good.
Yeah. Well, with any luck, it'll turn around and we'll see the excitement come back.
It almost axiomatically will. So you almost never lose money in markets. So you buy Germany in 39, you're ahead by 54.
Obviously
in dollars.
There's a few issues with that, but still.
But that's what I mean. It is so rare that you lose all your money in 17 in Russia. That's a big one. You lose all your money in 49 in China. Staggeringly unusual for you to lose money in any other market. Like, if you could have hedged the Zimbabwean dollar, you would have made money. You would have made money. No, I'm not kidding. You would have made money in Venezuela if you could hedge the Venezuelan real or whatever it's called.
Strip out the currency risk.
Yeah, if you could hedge that out, like you always. So, because companies adapt and change, right? And as long as the ownership structure remains uninterrupted, it's staggeringly unusual for you to lose over long enough periods of time.
In markets more broadly, you can lose specific things.
in markets in general.
Yes.
That's what I'm 100% what I meant. Yeah. I don't mean individual stocks.
You can absolutely lose money in specific stocks.
Yeah,
100%.
Sorry, to be clear, survivorship bias, you know, notwithstanding.
Yeah.
But I mean that. And also the Chinese playbook revolves around the use of markets. It's not like it's a nice to have and a maybe. If you don't think that the Chinese know that the use of markets has been rather important in the last 50 years, I don't think you understand them at all.
I think it's really fascinating. I remember this going to China as a relatively young person, and also Vietnam, which was very, very communist when I went, and I went to places where there were no white people at all, and I had red hair at the time, and it's quite interesting for them as well as for me. And but they're massively capitalist societies, right? Everything is market based because you're bartering all the time. Every single person has an extremely good understanding of how prices are arrived at. It's not walking into a store and paying the price that's been decided by someone in head office. It's literally face-to-face discussion about what you're willing to pay for something. Their understanding of supply and demand is so much more well-developed, I think, than anyone in a Western country who grew up in a non-barter system.
Totally. Go to China,
I found it fascinating.
Go to Chinatown.
Yeah.
Like, go to any Chinatown in any city.
Yeah, it's
like,
all small business and it's all bartering, and it's a market economy in the true sense.
Yeah.
Very different to sort of the more sanitised version that we're more familiar with.
So that looks like – the other thing too is it's not like everything is dirt cheap. Really good companies are sensibly priced. I mean, we've been looking at a thing called Sun Resin. Sun Resin's fascinating. I mean, just the typical Chinese success story, founded by a husband and wife pair who were both, one's a graduate, one's a doctorate in industrial chemistry, and they started doing resins. And so resins do all sorts of things. These are adsorption resins. So you stick things to them and then you take the things that you stick to them off. And so you use it for purification and all sorts of stuff. So originally it was used to purify food. They now dominate lithium. So dominate anyone who's doing direct lithium extraction, which is sort of a dumb name, non-evaporative lithium extraction using membranes, has either talked to or is using Sun Resin. There's no way they're not totally globally. And they look like there's something like 60% of all of the resin that goes into the next GLP-1 mega drug, which is tirzepatide.
Right.
So either Mounjaro or Zepbound.
Not been paying attention to this, Ozempic is the big thing.
Yeah.
It's the one that makes you lose tons of weight and has stripped, 40% off the value of ResMed and whatnot. Yeah. So if you weren't paying attention to that, that's what we're referring to now.
Yeah. So they're GLP-1 inhibitors or antagonists, and there's GLP and CLP or something is the next one, and tirzepatide is the next one. You can just see it in the share price of Eli Lilly. Mm-hmm. So it's Eli Lilly's version of Novo Nordisk's one. Mm-hmm. So that's a staggering success story from being founded 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of business, you can buy, you know, sort of high 20s multiple of earnings. This is not a recommendation. It's just like, we don't own it, by the way. We've been looking at it. We don't know how to think about it. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it just, has it just got lucky twice?
Yeah.
Right. You know, if I buy it on 30, I want to get a few good years out of it.
Yeah.
Right. Like 10. Mm. So for it to pay me, and I've got no idea what it looks like in 5 years because I don't know how well tirzepatide will do. And if tirzepatide is one of the biggest drugs of all time, it gets like 700 million RMB revenue. That's not all good. Like it's 100 million bucks.
Mm.
Big deal. So what am I trying to say? There is unbelievable innovation and dynamism and competitiveness in that place that throw up exceptional businesses run by exceptional business people. I mentioned BYD before.
Mm.
Like if people don't know the name Wang Chuanfu, they don't understand anything about electric vehicles. He is the absolute god of these things. He's the reason that Buffett bought BYD. He has done it again and again and again. He did not come in and buy a design off another couple of guys and use batteries from laptops to put into cars and import. He did everything.
You can go back and listen to Julian's thoughts on Elon Musk in previous episodes.
Yeah. So Wang Chuanfu got the battery's right. You got the form factors right. This guy was a battery guy who was a chemist, industrial chemist and physics. I think he studied both. He worked at a government instrumentality, set up the first lithium ion battery business in China to compete to get batteries into Motorola phones originally, Ericsson and Motorola phones originally way back when. Set that up. And then he bought a car company in like 2003.
Mm-hmm.
He bought a bankrupt car company in Sichuan or somewhere, and then from there has built the biggest EV maker in the world. And when people talk about BYD versus Tesla, they say, oh, they're close rivals. BYD's twice the size.
Mm.
They make 3 million cars. Tesla does 1.8, right? So why? What's the difference? Oh, we just forget about all the plug-in hybrids, right? Because that guy and his design team invented what plug-in hybrids are becoming. We think Toyota will now copy the BYD, the DMI engine series. So it's like a very, very simple internal combustion engine with no gear, and then an EV associated with it. So for tooling around like 100-150k range, you just use the batteries. And if you need to go fast on a highway at high gear, you just step into the internal combustion. That's the reverse of the way anyone else did it. Brilliant. Brilliant. And yet people will tell you, oh, China's uninvestable. So, but you don't understand it. You're not close to it. You don't know anything about it. And you're not close to any of the businesses enough to know what any of them are worth or not. And unless you get like a 1917 or a 1949 style event, you will probably make money. Mm. Like that's just the history of markets, right? So the other one that crops up a lot is, oh, but it's just like Russia. It's nothing like Russia. Russia's GDP per capita has gone up by twice since 89. My recollection, and it's worth checking, China's has gone up 40x.
Mm.
No, I think it's four times in Russia. I think it's four times in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And in China it's gone up 40x in dollars. They're both in dollars.
And life expectancy in Russia is falling as well.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. And you're seeking to tell me that they're the same model.
Mm.
That's the same economic model, is it? That's crazy. That's crazy. That's like saying a lion is the same as a tabby cat. they're just incomparably different. So that's China.
Right. So a lot to think about.
Mm.
I do think for many investors, there was so much hype, as I said, and there was a lot of excitement about China for a while there, and it's drifted away and we just don't see the appetite anymore. And sometimes that's the most interesting time to start looking, right? You're certainly not, and I wasn't planning to come to the US, but you're not suddenly buying all-time highs, and that's always nice. It's nice not to be buying at all-time highs.
It's nice, yeah.
Depressing. Yeah. And I can tell you for certain that NabTrade investors hate buying at all-time highs. They hate it. As markets get higher and higher, we see less and less buying.
Yeah.
And we see more and more cash on the sidelines. Everyone's waiting for a pullback. It makes people really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
They've learned to wait.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Thankfully, COVID gave everyone a marvelous opportunity to go and top up everything they liked.
Well, that's really fascinating because I think that really resonates with me because what I observe is so, like most market participants I observe are so conditioned to buy the dip. Everyone just knows
so
buy the dip.
Buy the dip, buy the dip. What is more, I think more valuable to know, not just buy the dip, but buy the quality in the dip.
Yeah.
Don't necessarily go and take something.
Get a whole lot of Beyond Meat.
I should have thought you'd go
Nicola
to Beyond Meat.
Or,
So, you know, Zip, for example, you know, it was $13 and it's now $12. Jump in. You know, that sort of thing. It's we don't see that so much, thankfully, which is really good. We tend to see, you know, BHP's come off a bit, Woodside's come off a bit, all the banks are coming off a bit. I'll describe a little bit. The hate CBA at the moment.
Yeah.
No one's interested in buying CBA at 113.
Just because it's expensive, I suppose.
Just
sensible.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So the conversations about something that is looking very unsexy to other people are usually the ones people have the most interest in, right?
Yeah.
Which is good.
That is really
good. So let's go to something that is at all-time, not all-time highs.
But all-time highs.
It is. Okay, fine. Japan.
Yep.
All-time highs.
Took out the all-time high yesterday.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. So
on the Nikkei, not the topics. The Nikkei 225 took out the all-time high yesterday.
So for those who are very young, younger than I am anyway, you probably never heard about the economic miracle of Japan, but it was all that was talked about when I was studying economics. It was kind of, this is a country that was absolutely decimated after the war and had to rebuild from extreme levels of poverty, you know, two nuclear bombs, you know, it was absolutely devastated.
Yeah.
This is how it modernized and became this extraordinary economic miracle. And by the time I was learning about it, it was like, oh, things are a bit iffy now. No one said if you bought an apartment in 1989, you would still be underwater well into the 2010s.
Yeah.
But that's ultimately how it's played out, right? Like it was just unbelievable how that success story collapsed. And now we are where we are. What's going on?
Japan is possibly going through one of the big revolutionary changes in its history. So Japanese history, I mean, I suppose like all places, but I think particularly characteristic of Japan is sort of a punctuated equilibrium style of place. So Japan in 1599 made more muskets than almost any other.
Sorry. I love the history. We've gone back to 1599.
Well, it's really important.
I love it.
Yeah. So in 1599, Japan's a modern industrial power. It's making muskets.
Mm.
It's making more of them than almost any single European state. But remember, there's not big states. We haven't quite gone through the state formation process, so it's all little principalities and crap. So then the Battle of Sekigahara happens in 1600. The Battle of Osaka in like 1612, and then you get a full takeover. So the shogunate, so that book Shogun is based on the Tokugawa shogunate. There was no industrial activity; it was all banned.
They closed the borders for 400 years.
They closed the borders.
Mm.
Yeah,
400 years.
Not quite. So
not quite
up until Admiral Perry in like 1850s.
Okay. 350.
Meiji Restoration 1868, I think, really opened it up. So what was that all about? That was about a faction of the Japanese power structure taking over the state and saying, in order to maintain control, that the national slogan became expel the barbarian.
Right.
Yeah, that was the right. So if you've ever seen the movie Silence, that's when, don't watch it, it's awful.
Yeah.
Like people doing accents. Hi, I'm an Italian guy. If you, like, it's like, dude, if he's speaking in his native language, he wouldn't have an accent.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Right. Just please, you know. Anyway, Liam Neeson doing Italian accent, awesome.
Oh.
Anyway, but historically interesting, right, because the Jesuits go there and try and convert people, Jean de Brebeuf and a few people, I think was one, and they get killed badly. That's that. Then the Meiji Restoration happens and literally you go from being like wearing a top knot, carrying the two swords, so you're a samurai, to if you do that tomorrow, we'll kill you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Didn't muck around?
Not messing around.
Right.
However, everybody who's in that power structure gets sort of suborned in order to sort of support the new thing. So basically all those things, Toyota's a place, so not that one, but Idemitsu, Mitsui, Sumitomo, on and on, they're samurai families.
Yeah, wow.
They get given government bonds and they can live off the income, and then those who are really industrious go and become steel makers and chemical makers and blah, blah, blah. That's where the Shosha, the trading companies and the great industrial companies come from, most of them. That then takes you up to the war years, and then the war, pre-war thing, Japan wasn't a particularly pleasant place. It copied Prussian militarism, so it literally styled itself on the progenitor of the German, you know, imperialist fascist state. That, like, they started killing, you know, finance ministers and prime ministers and whatever, because the military basically took over. And so then you get, so this is largely a continuous history, and then the war years happen, and that gets told as, and then the war happened and they had to start from zero. No, they didn't.
Mm.
No, they didn't. They destroyed maybe 15% of the industrial base of Japan. Maybe.
Interesting.
It's very difficult to destroy a place from the air. You can't do it. You can't do it. There's very few examples in history of anyone doing that. You know, even places like Dresden, right, where you firebomb the whole city, it still has an industrial base, right? The foundations are still there. The pipes are still there, right? So anyway, so Japan is this economic miracle all the way through to the 70s, and then it really feels itself, right? So now, like, 9 of the 10 biggest companies in the world in 89, 9 of the 10 biggest companies by market cap were Japanese. You know it. Mm. Most people won't. And then you get just the great shame of the 89 bubble collapse, and they don't really do anything until all the way through to 96 and then 99. They have a full-blown banking crisis. They have to recapitalize the banking system. They really don't do any fiscal stimulus of any note. They don't do quantitative easing until the late 90s, early 2000s. If you want to read all this, Richard Werner is your man who wrote Princes of the Yen. This is now something different. So this is now that whole history, samurai families and Japan Inc. and blah, 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 the entire through line of all that is, you're foreign, you don't understand, shut up. Right? That's what Kerr, my old boss, would say about going to Japanese meetings. It was just useless. They'd never listen, blah, blah, blah. That is totally different.
Interesting.
Right? So heads of IR and CEOs and CFO level folks are saying, what do you think we should do? Or we've been listening to investors and this is what we're doing, blah, blah, blah. And that sounds really trivial. And it sort of is pretty trivial if it's just paying a whole bunch of divvies because we've got cross shareholdings and cash. But if it's a whole return on equity, return on capital dividend that the whole society hits on, oh, God, we've actually got to use capital well or else we'll get old and poor. And you then get very cheap unit labour, because Japanese unit labour is really, really cheap. So it's not cheap to hire a person, but that person will be very productive. So per unit of what they can output, they're very cheap. Plus about the cheapest power in the industrialised world once they restart the whole nuclear fleet, which I'm sure they'll do. And also all the Japanese industrialists are talking about hydrogen, which is fascinating. So why would they be talking about hydrogen? So they're taking the decarbonisation thing really seriously, but it ain't going to work using natural gas because they import that on ships. So that's not a great way of doing it. So it looks a lot like they'll do some form of hydrogen via electrolysis from nuclear power. And if you get all of that come together, you get cheap power, cheap unit labour, a real tight eye on the highest and best use of capital in a society, we're talking about a very different place in 15 years.
Interesting. So thoughts about Japan? You guys have been in Japan a long time.
Well, we've run a Japan fund for 25 years.
Yeah. It's,
you know, I don't say this stuff much. It's been spectacularly successful.
Yeah, right. So this is where it gets most interesting. The other thing is everyone I know is in Japan or has been to Japan recently or is going very soon. It's suddenly become an extraordinary tourist destination, which I'm sure is in no way relevant to their economy. But for whatever reason, lots of people are interested in Japan again.
It's very relevant to their economy. Yeah. Now, tourism is one of their big industries.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's become quite a thing, which is quite fascinating. It wasn't a conversation we were having 10 years ago. It is now.
Yep.
So as an opportunity then, as I said, investors certainly at NabTrade, we don't love buying at the top. No one likes that. All-time highs makes everyone very uncomfortable. But after 30-plus
Japan's
years
so cheap.
In the wilderness, they're not super high
no,
highs.
No, it's so, Japan's ridiculously cheap.
Mm.
Like Toyota Motor Corp's on about 9x earnings this year, we think.
Wow.
They are the best automaker in the world. Mm. You know, they're so impressive. They've just been right about EVs.
Mm.
You know, remember 5 years ago, everyone was saying, oh, you guys suck, Elon Musk, oh. Mm. And they didn't say no. They just said, yeah, we don't think it's an awesome solution for mass market autos. You know, we have a really big model stack. So, no, we'll get there when we think it's, like, sensible. Mm. And also we don't want to rely on government subsidies to have to do it.
Mm.
So we'll get there. So what are they doing now? They're doing lots of EVs. Half their fleet is hybrids, by the way.
Mm.
They invented the hybrid, so they know quite a lot about, you know, electrifying the drivetrain.
Mm.
You know, remember the Prius?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you wouldn't even know it's a hybrid.
Mm.
Every Corolla you get into is a bloody hybrid.
Yeah.
So, like, they do it already. They're probably, we think, going to do a plug-in hybrid EV along the BYD lines as well. And that's really interesting because, again, that's a Japanese corporate learning from a Chinese corporate, we think. That's just our guess based on body language in a meeting.
But well, there are worse ways to assess the situation.
But we think it's right. So, so because plug-in hybrids are really important in a whole bunch of ways. Places that have to drive a long way all at the one time, so China, EVs suck. Because if you have to, like, so imagine tens of millions of EVs on the road, right, and them having to recharge at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, that's not very
infrastructure
fun.
Needs to be pretty
that's not very fun.
Impressive.
Yeah. So plug-in hybrid EVs work really well. They'll work probably really well in Australia as well. They'll work really well in areas of Europe. Lots of places that don't have great, you know, parking infrastructure and power outlets and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that could work really well. The grid is an issue around all that, but, you know, that is for everything. You know, everything's rechargeable. So, you know, all the same. So, that's on one end. That's on sort of on the high quality end. There's another thing, you know, I'm pretty interested in, which is a little thing called Nitetsu Mining. That company's literally free. Like the equity's worth zero.
Wow.
So that's not a bad start.
Downside's pretty limited.
Yeah. So if you just go through the balance sheets of Japanese companies, certainly formerly hundreds. I'm not sure now. I haven't seen this done for a while, but I would say at least certainly dozens and dozens have more cash than market cap. Many, many, many of them, probably into the 100 plus, have more cash and securities holdings than market cap. And then if you add in real estate that's held at cost, so unimproved value from, you know, whenever, lots and lots of companies have more value on the balance sheet, realizable value on the balance sheet than equity value, right? That's a pretty good start point. So Nitetsu Mining is about to double copper production and it can borrow in Japan at low borrowing costs and it's not a very good company. right? It's not.
I just don't think of the Japanese as mine as much, but, you know.
Yeah, that's because they're not. but they've done one and they're about to do another one. So Arakama Kozan is in production and they're doing another one called Arqueros and that's all fully funded and if they need to top it up, they can use a corporate facility in Japan. So it makes sense because they have a pretty diversified, you know, if that was in America, it would have been split up, private equity, everything was everywhere and everything's gone to its highest and best use and it would have one thing doing copper and it would have to borrow at project finance rates in copper, which is going to be an all-in rate of like 20% once you've paid for your hedging. They can probably borrow at 2.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's very valuable. So there's just stories like that all over Japan.
So much to think about. I'm going to ask you one last question.
Do it.
Talk to us about what's going on in the US.
Yeah.
And how you're feeling about it. I'm fascinated to hear.
So, I mean, on a personal level, very humbled. So, you know, if you wind the clock back a year ago, there were certainties that I had, none of which happened. So, you know, you can't have a yield curve inversion like that. You can't be running a budget deficit of, you know, sort of fives back then, pre-recession, without either rates going up and you lose the long end of the curve and so borrowing costs go up a lot, or you tighten and then you tighten yourself into recession, all that stuff. So this needle has just been threaded. There's been two drivers. One is a staggering fiscal deficit.
Do you want to talk quickly about what that means for people? For anyone who's listening, so we've covered a lot of ground, a lot of stock-specific stuff, a lot of economic history, and a lot of sort of macro concepts. We haven't talked about the fiscal deficit in the US at all. And if you're not paying attention, it's quite meaningful.
It's because no one – it's a tough topic because no one knows what government debt really is because it's a debt that's owed – largely by a system to itself in a unit of measurement that it just makes up. Like, I know that sounds like, you know.
It's going to make it very challenging for anyone to draw any conclusions.
I know that sounds like real, like, first-year bong rip logic, right? Mm. But it's true. So it is quite difficult to parse out what all that means, particularly because there's just not a lot of high-quality collateral in the system. And so, therefore, maybe increasing the collateral in the system is good. Like, there's basically no AAA issuers, like, in the world. Like, there's, like, two.
So...
Can you remember who they are? It's like bloody... It's like Coca-Cola and Rabobank or something. I can't remember who it is. There used to be hundreds of companies in the world who were AAA issuers. Well, hundreds is probably an exaggeration, but there was dozens of companies in the world that were AAA issuers. There's now none, in effect. So how does an insurer or an endowment or a sovereign wealth fund that has to match liabilities, assuming the sovereign wealth fund has to match, like, social liabilities, how do they match those liabilities? With what asset? Well, I don't have any. I don't have many. And then I want to get a yield out of it. Oh, go back 5 years ago, that was pretty tough. So now we're going through this weird thing where there is an almost insatiable appetite for the collateral that is represented by these government securities, with basically no credit risk, because the government ain't going to go broke. It can go broke if it wants to, but no government ever goes broke unless it wants to, unless it cedes the right to its own currency. Who would do that? I mean, all of Europe did it. That was maybe not that smart. But so that's the framework. The more near-term reality is we're printing a government deficit of probably about 6% of GDP now, having been about 8.5% sort of percent of GDP for a couple of quarters middle of last year.
So all of this is sounding very, very challenging to understand. Effectively, US government is borrowing tons of money and ploughing it into the economy.
Yeah.
And there's the Inflation Reduction Act, which is gorgeously named.
Isn't it
because
good?
It will do the exact opposite of reducing inflation by spending tons of money and so many other things. And I'm assuming then that it's your contention that that is a meaningful driver of economic growth.
Dude, totally.
So just arithmetically, last year, 3% of GDP growth was the deficit.
Yeah.
It went from round about 5 to around about 8.
Yeah.
That's just arithmetically what that means.
Yeah. Government just paid for growth.
Just paid for it. And the multiplier is bigger than that because there's lots of incentive-y type stuff flowing all through the economy, which, you know. And then, like, I just ask people to always remember economies work in a simplified way in the Hyman-Minsky model. So there's three, so close the system and don't export or import anything. Mm-hmm. And there's just three sectors. So there's households, corporates, and government. If one prints a deficit, the other two must automatically and axiomatically be receiving a surplus.
Mm.
It cannot work any other way. Now, it sounds like that is consequence-free, but it might not be.
Mm.
Because there are probably like moral hazardy type risks, like I insure someone to drive really fast so they drive too fast and kill kids or whatever. That's a moral hazard. There's that kind of thing. I don't know. The inflation thing's a big risk. Like, it is so, so dangerous for people to be saying, hey, glad we got that inflation thing licked.
Yes, there was a bit of that, wasn't there?
There's a lot of it.
Mm.
There's a lot of it still,
mm-hmm.
actually. Wages in the States are going up 5. So the Atlanta Fed wage tracker is going up 5.
Wow.
And wages in Australia are going up 4.2, whatever the last data point was.
Mm.
These are totally dominantly services-based economies around which, like, that's what inflation will gravitate toward. You can offset it a bit. So if you have productivity, you know, that's above wage growth, you'll offset that a little bit.
And what we definitely don't have.
Which we definitely don't have.
Not in Australia anyway.
No, and not in the States either.
Yeah.
Productivity is like at all-time lows.
Mm.
We're probably not measuring it right. It's a very difficult question. What we have had is the offsetting of services inflation via goods deflation, because we had a goods inflationary surge that then deflated and followed by a services inflationary surge, which was like the top was knocked off by oil, went from 90 to 70, right, and back to 80. But it's still been deflationary in lumber and freight transport and diesel and blah, blah, blah. They've all been
supply chain.
Yeah, exactly. Supply chains. And now latterly, housing.
Hmm.
So the owner's equivalent rent will probably now be a deflationary thing. Like what do I mean by that? It'll lower inflation, all else being equal, for like the next year or something. We had a very similar event. This is work from Nancy Lazar, who's very good. We had a very similar thing in the late 60s. We had resurgent inflation. Then it got knocked on the head, but it didn't get cured.
Mm.
You had a raging bull market for a few years up until 70, and then you're in the 1970s.
Mm.
So if you get really pronounced monetary debasement, so just printing and printing and printing with low productivity growth, with no deflation exported from China anymore, certainly not into the US, because like they're trying their best to decouple from that, with very, very problematic energy settings, like where the hell all the thermal coal is going to come from in like 8 years' time, I can't tell you, let alone met coal. So good luck with all that, because they're going to need some steel, right? So all of these things are all building into the system. So what looks like it's no problem could be quite a big problem. But right now, it certainly doesn't look like it. These economic systems look like they're re-accelerating. So, like, why would I say that? So new orders are higher than inventories for the first time, and PMIs for like years, you know, 2.5 years or something. Like these are actually systems that look like they're reaccelerating now, really genuinely, with this sort of possible very slow sting in the tail from what we're doing on the fiscal side, which isn't being lent against on the monetary side. And that's both of those things are really very surprising to me.
Thoughts then on where the US market finds itself?
Where's NVIDIA going to go?
Honestly, it's all anyone cares about.
But it is, it, like, actually, it's isn't. Just worth dwelling on that, Gemma, for a second. Like, it, you know, that is the most staggering thing. And the numbers just are the numbers. So in 2 years and a bit, it's added $45 billion of revenue at a gross margin of 60%. So it's done $45 million incremental revenue and done $30 billion, just under, of incremental profit before tax. Wow.
Mm.
Now, here's the rub. These aren't things you eat.
Yeah.
These are things you buy in order to use. No one is monetizing AI. No one is monetizing AI.
Despite everyone talking about it.
What do you pay for?
Mm.
What do you pay for, dear listener, for its AI?
Mm.
I can't think of anything, right? Maybe some advertising, but I would have paid for that anyway, right? So, and yet we've just added $45 billion in capital goods, right, in revenue to a sector. Like, so this is a capital cycle.
And we are, and most of the capital is coming from, what, the next five of the Magnificent Seven?
Yeah.
So much of the CapEx, from what I can understand anyway, is coming
from
Microsoft.
Totally. But they're all developing their own chips as well. So, look, we're just going to – and it's fine. It won't be the end of the world. We're just going to have an inventory cycle, and all of a sudden the pricing will have to come down. And the other thing that's really entertaining too is people saying, oh, that guy at OpenAI or whatever it was who's saying, oh, we need $7 trillion. Right? So, okay.
If anyone missed that, he asked for $7 trillion.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a terrible industry. That's a terrible
industry. Your kids are making up numbers now.
Yeah. But those trillions used to really add up.
Yeah.
It's but so that's a bad industry.
Mm.
Capital-intensive industries are bad.
Mm.
Not good.
Mm.
Bad, right? Because what kind of – so 7% – 7 trillion is like 7% of global GDP. So like the total exports of like Japan are like –
everybody.
Yeah. Yep. You know, like the total traded sector is, you know, I don't know, 20-odd trillion. So it's a good number.
Mm.
It's a capital versus a flow, so it doesn't really compare. But there is a lot of hype in these markets.
Mm.
Bubble's going to bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Bubbles go up.
Mm-hmm.
So, and now it's, there's an investing populace that has been instructed by history to buy the dip with loose monetary and fiscal settings with this very dominant theme. Jesus, could go anywhere. really, this could go anywhere. Don't know. But markets are pretty frothy where people are. But remember, if people are talking about a Magnificent Seven, which is now a Magnificent Five and probably a Four, a Fantastic Four or whatever, that's because it's leaving something else behind.
Yeah.
And I think you, before, in preparing for this, intelligently asked about the Russell, right? Like, which has just been left for dead.
Yeah.
There are signs that it's broadening.
Okay.
So the move has broadened quite a bit. Like, you know, the technical guys would talk about a breadth thrust or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's sort of looking a bit more encouraging. But the nice part is all these things are talked about in Japan, or all this stuff in China, or all this stuff, you know, like plenty of stuff in Australia is not all that expensive. Like, you know, I think our big miners are sort of all right.
Hmm.
Iron ore is pretty hard to say it's cheap at, you know, 120 or whatever it is today, 112. But the Chinese still want to buy it. So there's lots of stuff to own. We've got this hugely frothy thing going on, but it does look like it's got momentum again.
Julian, I don't know how much of this you put out in the world or whether people just have to tune in and listen. Where do people go to follow you and keep up with all of this stuff? You've always got so much to say. Well,
to follow me, nowhere. I'm on LinkedIn, sort of under sufferance, but I'm not on any social media. I think it's really bad for people's brains.
Do you publish it on your website? No?
Yeah. So if they want to hear from Platinum, so our quarterlies, we actually try really hard to talk about what we're doing and talk about what markets are doing. And so it's just platinum.com.au. That'd be about it.
Well, you just have to tune in to listen to you and get to talk about all sorts of absolutely fascinating things.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I plenty don't.
Julian McCormack from Platinum, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thank you so much for listening. Also, as always, we love hearing from you. We get fantastic feedback from you guys. Love getting your questions. Please just email us at yourwealth@nav.com.au, and I look forward to talking to you again soon. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.